Hello there, listeners and viewers, and welcome to another episode of Disrupt Ed, where we talk to those seemingly ordinary people who are actually out there having an extraordinary impact. And today we have a great episode with a great guest. You know, when you think about disruption in the higher ed space, it is all over the place. In this 5G wired, workforce augmented, technology interconnected, globally interdependent, AI accelerated, Web3 immersive, pandemic interrupted world of work and learning, it is crazy out there. We're seeing changes and disruptions at a pace and scale as never before. And in the world of higher education, we have some serious headwinds. We have an enrollment cliff that appears looming, where the demographics suggest that we will have a much lower population of people going on to college. And we also have a crisis of confidence, where people don't believe in the and have the same level of confidence in higher ed that they once did. Take, for example, the two things that are most causing this this sentiment are the ever-increasing cost of higher ed, where in some cases it's skyrocketed beyond belief. And secondly, in the relevancy of higher education, is it actually powering people to do better in their careers? So we have a titan of an education thought leader with us today. We have Brandon Bastide, who was the executive director of education at Workforce at Gallup. He went on to serve as president of Kaplan University Strategic Partnerships, and now is the CEO and president of Brand Ed. If you're not following him on LinkedIn, do yourself a favor and click on his feed, because he offers a lot of rich insights into the world of higher ed. Brandon, we are so delighted to have you here today.
Hey, Ron, thanks. It's good to be back on the show. It's always good to talk to you. And my head is spinning a little bit from your introduction. There's, as you noted, there's a lot going on. A lot to be worried about. And it's a lot to unpack in these kinds of conversations.
Well, you know,
good to be with you.
I kind of look at that as a litmus test. If you can say those words three times fast, then you probably don't have any need to listen in. But if you can't do that, then you probably should be listening to our episodes on the disruption going on, because there's a lot to sort through. And you are clearly just an animated, passionate expert on it. I love your posts. I love following you. And to our listening and viewing audience, you're in for a treat here. So let's kick this off, Brandon. I know you've said in the past that colleges must stop acting like colleges. What do you mean by that? And what should they start acting like instead?
Well, I think there's a few points around that. You know, when you think about the traditional position that colleges and universities have taken in terms of how they present themselves to students, how they market themselves. What's interesting is that there's very little differentiation in terms of how you might look at the description of one particular institution over another. And although it's true that we have a very diverse higher ed system in the U.S., we obviously have community colleges, we have four-year public and privates, we have regional institutions. Certainly, there are some important distinctions there, but in the grand scheme of things, most of the messaging that colleges and universities have put out there to market the value of what they provide has been really, really consistent. In fact, it's hard to actually say what's the difference between one institution and another in terms of asking people really distinct characteristics of it. And although there's a handful where they have a distinct brand or a distinct signature to who they are or what they do, for the most part, it's an undifferentiated market. And I think that's becoming a real challenge. You know, it was easy to be in that kind of place when there was growth in enrollments. And we saw strong growth in higher ed enrollments up until about 2011. Since then, higher ed enrollments have been on a decline. And to your point, you know, now facing a population age demographic that's really going to accelerate that decline. Now it becomes pretty important to be highly differentiated in a market of otherwise sameness.
You know, I think you're right. And I think one of the things that occurs to me is that for a lot of freshmen coming into college, you know, sometimes when I listen to them talk, their reasons for going to a college, you know, they sound very, I guess for lack of a better word, superficial or not well informed. And especially if they lock into their freshman, you know, major or their perceived career path, and they say, okay, I want the best environmental science, you know, program. So they go there, and then suddenly, you know, a semester in, that's not there. You know, that's not for them, and they have to do. I mean, what do you advise in a case like that? I mean, I think it compounds the problem you're talking about, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it you know, there's a couple interesting kind of points around the backdrop and context of what you said. You know, historically, most students end up going to a college or university near where they grew up, right? So the idea that most people go away or go off to college is counter to the data, right? Most people choose an institution fairly close to home, within 50 miles of, you know, where they grew up. So on one hand, you know, it's an indicator that, you know, they're going to a place that they know, as in a place that's close by and near. And you say, okay, there might be real reasons for that. I want to be able to live with family. I want to stay in an area where I know people. Those are really important reasons. I don't have the money to go away and live, you know, residentially. But I also think it represents just a lack of imagination and understanding about what's out there, right?
Right.
Because if you are a graduate from high school who has a really clear idea of what you want to study, there are indeed universities, college universities, that have better, more specific programs around some of those areas, right? Where if you knew that, you know, this one particular institution had the best XYZ program, you would really try to seek it out. I think, you know, more and more students and parents are certainly doing better, more informed homework about college and universities. But I think you're right. You know, the other thing you mentioned was that they seem to have really superficial reasons. You know, we've always said, hey, get a college degree. Why? Because, well, that's the right thing to do, or that's what we've assumed you're always going to do. And you're starting to see that narrative kind of crack away a little bit, where there are indeed a lot of really viable alternatives to a college degree, alternatives to high wage, you know, family sustaining wage jobs. And it's starting to kind of change the way that parents and students are thinking about this. The automatic idea that I'm just going to go to college after high school is not always as automatic as it was in the past.
Well, it seems to me back to when you and I were in college, I was there before you, obviously, by a decade or so more. But, you know, when we both went to, you know, elite institutions. You went to Duke, I went to Michigan. And that brand in and of itself was the draw. And I would say in retrospect, when I look at my college education and preparation for life, I mean, it was a perfect fit for me. It did work out well. I'm a really passionate Wolverine alum, not just because of our extraordinary football team. I mean, we have just so many exciting things going on. And right here, we're taping live in the New Lab facility, which is right downtown Detroit. And the University of Michigan, thanks to Stephen Ross, is going to be building the University of Michigan Innovation Center right here in downtown. And it's a green building. It's extraordinary to look at. It's going up as we speak. So I think universities are clearly spending money on innovation and moving the needle. But, you know, tell me what you think of the idea that over a third of people, something like 36% of people, have lost confidence in higher ed. I mean, what do institutions do to turn that around?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The data on confidence in higher education has been something that Gallup started tracking a good while ago. And, you know, it's against the backdrop of their historical tracking on confidence in all kinds of U.S. institutions, right? Confidence in the presidency, in Congress, in the judiciary, in small business, military, right? A whole bunch of different facets. And so there's a couple important things to say. One, there has been a precipitous decline in confidence in U.S. higher education over the last 12, 13 years, with the exception, and this is really recent breaking news in the last week of this year, where for the first time since Gallup started measuring that slide in confidence in higher education for more than a decade, there's been a slight bump back up in confidence in higher education. So overall, a decline over the last decade plus. relative to other institutions, confidence in other institutions, higher ed is hanging in there, right? It's not at the bottom like Congress is, for example. But you know, it's important to note that that slide has certainly had a detrimental effect on enrollments, on the idea of questioning the value of college and higher education. And what's interesting, though, Ron, this past week they just reported as part of the Gallup Lumina study a bump up in confidence in higher education. What's interesting is that if you get underneath the data on what's driving that small bump back up in confidence, it's not the traditional narrative of, hey, get a college degree, you'll get a better job and make more money throughout your life, which has been a common refrain about, like, why college? It's been driven more by people's sense that colleges and universities contribute to innovation in this country, and that relative to other higher ed industries around the world, that U.S. higher education is indeed really, really terrific. And what's interesting about those two points is that they're really more about what I would call the public benefit of higher education as opposed to the private benefit. Right. Right? Private benefit meaning you and I go to college, we get a college degree, it benefits us and our families economically. That's certainly an important benefit. But what's been driving this bump back up in confidence has been a renewed attention to the public benefits of higher education, right? It's amazing contributions made through research, innovation in terms of things that help drive our economy. It's ties to national security. You know, I have a good friend and colleague who was presenting at a conference. He spent his career in national security. And during that conference, he said, everything that matters to national security was birthed at a U.S. university, right? And it's just, I mean, first of all, a great quote, but I think it's those messages that are starting to be renewed in our dialogue about higher education. And I think it's really interesting. It goes back to this point about how institutions differentiate themselves. You also say, what messages does higher education writ large send about itself that improves its overall competence and image? And it's just interesting to point out that it's been more of the public benefits of higher education as opposed to the private benefits that seem to be moving the needle this year.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think a lot of people are extremely naive when it comes to the fact that most major technology developments that are commercialized, the Apple iPhone, for example, much of the research that led to that came out of our public university system. So I think that's worth, you know, that's worth propelling as part of the narrative. But are you at all concerned that in recent years, we have an administration, no politics intended here, but it seems to me that the narrative, anytime you listen to media now about higher education, it's taking down a university for its diversity inclusion efforts. It's taking a university down for being elitist. You know, the Ivy League presidents that were on Capitol Hill to testify didn't necessarily leave the impression with a lot of people that this is a, you know, this is a public benefit. This is good for everyone. It did ring a bit elitist in my view. Was that your concern? You know, are you of the same mind on that?
Well, look, there's some real critique around the negativity about elitism when people think about higher education. And of course, that gets disproportionately placed on a small handful of our most elite, most highly selected universities. This has actually been a traditional bias of the higher ed media and of the press in general, is that they write a disproportionate number of articles about places like Harvard or the Ivy League.
Right.
And certainly over the last several years, right, a lot of that has become increasingly negative around the specific idea of elitism, right? There's been negativity about elitism in general, and that has been applied very specifically to our elite colleges and universities. It unfairly paints, you know, a very distorted view of U.S. higher education more broadly, because, of course, most colleges and universities in the U.S. are not highly selective. Many of them are open access right. institutions where access and affordability are a core attribute of their mission. But if you just step back and you say the word college and universities, a lot of people immediately think Harvard, elite, Ivy League, right? And so, look, there is some truth to the criticism around some of that elitism. But if you also step back and say Harvard, the research institution that has contributed to innumerable number of advancements in healthcare, cancer research, we could go on and on. For those of you who are, you know, history buffs, you know that napalm was invented at Harvard on the soccer field, just on campus there. And so, you know, I mean, there's an incredible set of contributions that elite higher ed has made to the entire country, whether anybody has ever set foot on the Harvard campus or not. And so, you know, but that narrative has gotten very tangled into politics, into political polarization, the sense that colleges and universities don't allow students to think for themselves, that there is some kind of bias in terms of how and what they are taught. You know, there's a real sense of that happening now across the country. And I think it's one of the challenges that we need to address. When I say we, higher ed specifically, right, needs to take a look at, is it doing things that are continuing to, you know, contribute negatively to that narrative? What could it do to change the way people see and contribute to that narrative? So it's not all on the shoulders of higher ed, but I do think there's always some small truth or kernel to the critiques.
Yeah. To our listening and viewing audience, you're listening to Brandon Bastid here. And I just want to point out, as you're listening, this is why I love talking to this guy, because we have a lot of big issues out there. And rather than polarizing the issues, Brandon does such a unique and admirable job of kind of coursing through the data and giving us a much richer context for what's going on in higher ed, because I think a lot of people want to throw the critiques out there. But you're saying, in effect, though, in your role as CEO at Brand Ed, but more broadly as a thought leader in the space, what you've been saying is, you know, brand is the important thing to move on. And in this world of disruption, you know, higher ed is facing a brand warfare, so to speak. And if you think about it from a marketing perspective, you would be telling your university or institution, if you were in that seat as a CMO, you'd be telling them, let's get our messaging back. Let's do, you know, let's talk about this. Let's get a narrative going about that. So talk to us about brand. And if that's the new curriculum, what do you mean by that? And where do you think it's going?
Well, look, it's not as simple as marketing. You know, I think when a lot of people hear the word brand, they think it's, you know, about fancy advertising and marketing. I think it's about clarifying organizational values and distinctiveness. And if you do that well, the brand is true to who you are. It has to be, right? And, right, you know, you might be able to get away for a while with fancy marketing that doesn't really align to the service and the quality and the values you deliver. You might be able to get a short-term pop in visibility or in enrollments from that. But at the end of the day, you know, where I've seen institutions really thrive and be successful is that they're, you know, they've been distinctive in their branding, and that distinctiveness is true to their culture and values and what they deliver on and the experience that students have. And look, you know, I'll give you examples of ones that have really stood out. You take a Northeastern University, which has been, you know, invested in the co-op model for more than 100 years, but they have remained true to the work readiness of its graduates. That model that was, you know, that is 100 years old is suddenly white hot because there is so much emphasis on, you know, students getting well prepared for success in the workplace. Northeastern is one of those institutions that delivers on that really well. And so, you know, it's not that Northeastern suddenly did something fancy and different in their market.
Right. It's really
just got really clear on the value proposition of work readiness, right? And it's true to who they are. You think about another institution near them, Babson. Babson is known for entrepreneurship, right? It's a tiny liberal arts institution, but they've made a really distinctive signature around preparing students for entrepreneurship. And then you think about, you know, two of the largest universities in the world now, Southern New Hampshire University and Western Governors University. Plenty of people talk about them. But look, they were barely on the radar not even 25 years ago, right? WGU is a little over 25 years old. Southern New Hampshire institution has been around for a while, but it became a behemoth because it launched an online division of the organization. That's barely 25 years old. And so these two massive institutions have gotten to where they are in just 25 years, roughly, which is remarkable. But they've been very clear about who they serve, right? They have focused on serving working adults. They have focused on the message of access and affordability and speed to degree and getting credit for prior work that you have done and prior credits from other institutions. And so they have both been institutions that have honed in on a very, very specific value proposition and student demographic that they serve. And it has served them incredibly well.
You know, I think that's a really great insight. And it prompts me to think of two universities that come front of mind for me. One is right here in our backyard here in downtown Detroit, and that's Wayne State. Wayne State got very, very focused on two things over the last decade or so. And it's about increasing their completion rate, which was, you know, just extremely low. And they started making the campus more hospitable as a non-commuter. You know, it's largely for most of the last 50 years, a commuter institution. And now they've created a lot more campus life to bring more people down, and with the idea that they would increase the diversity of opinions and experiences for students. And it's paying off racially. They're enjoying a real renaissance. And their completion rates are through the roof. Another example that comes to mind is the work Michael Crow and his team are doing at Arizona State. I mean, they are the beacon of innovation. They've been voted the most innovative university in the world for, you know, 10 years plus. But they're, you know, they power through innovative ideas. You look at the Arizona Prep University, the online high school that they built on campus. There's just a lot of innovation. So I think I wholeheartedly agree with your point. But as you look through it, it almost seems like those are the institutions that are going to win, and the ones that aren't and the ones that are closing now just don't have that. You know, we've had a number of, I think we've had 40, colleges and universities close in Michigan over the last several years. And in all cases, I think what we're seeing is the beginning of a time when simply having a small, quaint campus with small size classrooms isn't enough to cut it. It just isn't, because you have to look at the quality of the faculty that you're able to attract, the richness of the curriculum, all those things. As we're wrapping on this, Brandon, I want to ask you, you know, in your work at Brand Ed, you know, you talk about Brand Ed's curriculum as well. And is there a part to play, you know, talk a little bit about the play you have with higher ed institutions and some of the extraordinary course offerings you're developing and have launched. The Sotheby's one is always at the top of mind for me because I'm an art history minor. And in another life, I would have just coveted the opportunity to be part of that very, very rich experience.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, we occupy a really unique spot in the education ecosystem. The name Brand Ed has been a simple, quiet descriptor behind the scenes of the otherwise globally recognized and iconic organizations that we work with. So we operate, to your point, Sotheby's Institute of Art. We operate Vogue College of Fashion, Manchester City Sports Business School, and the School of the New York Times. So in each of those categories, right, whether we're talking about the art industry or fashion industry or the sport industry or journalism, you know, these are among, you know, they
marquee,
are.
Those are marquee brands.
Iconic brand, or they're in the argument for being the iconic brand organization. And so on the surface, you might go, oh, well, you know, it's all about, you know, they're globally recognized brands, and that's what attracts students to your program. Sure, that's part of it. But more importantly, it goes back to that point I made earlier. It's not just the brand, it's being consistent to the values and the quality of the experience you deliver. One of the things that we're able to do as a result of working with those iconic brands is to deliver on a student experience that just isn't available anywhere else, right? What do I mean by that? Access to industry experts, behind the scenes access to these organizations and the industry in general in ways that students can't otherwise access. And so it's delivering not just on the attractiveness of an iconic brand that might bring students into the fold of considering it, but it's delivering on an iconic experience for those students in terms of the, you know, the industry immersive educational access that we're able to provide. And so that I think is a really big part. And it's not, I mean, we have set a high bar. The students come to our programs. It's a high bar because they're going to a Vogue College of Fashion program and they are thinking about, you know, the high bar and high standards of a Vogue experience. It's not easy to deliver on, but it really keeps us on our toes in terms of making sure that we're aiming. Our aim is world class. Right. That's always the aim in terms of what we're trying to deliver.
Well, I think it's also interesting with the Sotheby's example in the New York Times. You know, journalism is in disarray. It's a highly disrupted industry. So that's a port in the storm as far as, you know, looking at, wow, if I'm still passionate about being part of the journalism world, but the model has completely changed, that's where I want to head to learn how I can navigate that, you know, and I think that's a very rich experience. And then the Sotheby's one, you know, I investigated that with you in a previous episode at some length. And what I took away was, you know, if you're an art history major or minor, you're not necessarily thinking about job careers in that industry. You're thinking about it as a strong liberal arts background, and it's a fascinating study. But you know, you learn about curation, you learn about you have access to auction houses, you have access to museums. I mean, it's just an extraordinary way to look at the learning experience. Any closing thoughts you have, Brandon, on this episode?
You know, we've talked about it in various ways throughout the episode, Ron, but I think, you know, one easy point or provocative point too to leave folks with is to think about the words and the language we use to describe what we do. And that may at first sound like a really subtle point. I think it's hugely important to this point of how does an individual institution differentiate? How does higher education bring itself closer to the general, you know, U.S. population in terms of defining more clearly its value proposition? And, you know, I'll give you this example. I was just at a conference a few weeks ago with a whole host of small private liberal arts institutions where we were talking about the name brand, the liberal arts, as something that's been used historically across higher ed, but today is a very challenged brand name. So the value of a liberal arts education, the pedagogy of it, is as important as it's ever been. You know, to have somebody who is broadly educated, specifically skilled, you know, that's the essence of liberal arts. But using the words liberal arts is a very, very tricky brand name right now. And we had this very rich conversation around different ways, different words to describe this historical language that we've used of the liberal arts, which dates back to ancient, you know, Greek times. But instead to say, hey, you know, this is a universal education that broadly prepares somebody for any number of careers. It's about teaching students durable skills. It's a durable education. We also talked about its original meaning, which is the skills necessary for a free person. Right. So actually saying that to me is better marketing than saying, hey, come to a liberal arts campus or get a liberal arts degree. So it's just a challenge to all of us to look at the words we're using, the language we're using, and say, is it really honed to do what we want it to do?
You know, I think that's a really strong point. I do a lot of career counseling for a very, very broad community of nieces and nephews, some biological, some just adopted. And what I find time and time again, when they're running confused about their first job, they're out of college and they're, you know, they're getting all kinds of pressure from their parents and everything. I always ask them, you know, to tell me about their, you know, their major. And very oftentimes they start out very defensively. Well, I'm just an English major. Or, well, I'm just a history major. And then I always ask them this question. Tell me about your capstone course. You know, and they say, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you know, when you're senior course after having studied history for 4 years, didn't you take a capstone course where you could crystallize things, bring them all together, and articulate what you've learned over the span of 4 years that's relatable to the world of work? They're like, no, we didn't have a class like that. My point is, I think liberal arts colleges, to your point, need that kind of capstone experience, because I was able to get it. I have two sons that are both liberal arts majors, and they had no difficulty finding a job, but they were trained and tested on their ability to describe with passion, enthusiasm, and erudition what it meant to be a liberal arts major and why it was actually important and how it actually benefit their work experience.
Yeah, I think just, a better language to describe what you've learned is a powerful piece. You know, I'll never forget, I was part of a focus group with students where we were asking them to describe how what they majored in was relevant to the jobs that they were in. So these are recent graduates, right? And a lot of them felt that what they studied in college wasn't relevant to their current job. But the deeper that you question them, all of a sudden they were like, oh yeah, now I do see how my English major is related to the work I'm doing in PR and communications, which on the surface, this was a student who was a recent graduate who had majored in English, was now in PR and communications, and didn't think that what they were doing had any relationship to what they studied in college until you started to piece some of the language together. And they're like, oh yeah, I guess it does.
I think language is a great navigational tool in this conversation. So to our listening and viewing audience, you've been listening to Rockstar, Titan, Education Tech Leader, Brandon Bastide. Brandon, I always enjoy talking with you, and I always take something big away in terms of your insights and your passion for the education industry. So thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ron. Always good to be with you. And thanks for the great job you do with this podcast. It's a great contribution to all the field.
Thank you. So to our listening and viewing audience, you know what that means. We want to hear from you. Give us your feedback. Share this conversation with others and get disrupted with us. Thanks again. Until next time.